Well, God had warned them. He had warned them over and over and over again. He had sent his messengers to them for hundreds of years now. The people of Judah and the people of Israel kept turning themselves away from God. They kept following after their own lust. They kept following after idols that were set up that were made out of metal and wood and stone. And they wouldn't listen. And God warned them. He said, if you don't turn back, if you don't repent, you're not going to stay here. This land that I've given to you, this land that flows with milk and honey, you're not going to get to stay. I'm going to send the people and they're going to take you away from here. But they wouldn't listen. They thought, we're the people of God. God delivered us. We have God's message. We have God's temple. God wouldn't do that. But he did. And he showed it to them, the northern kingdom of Israel, by taking them into captivity by the Assyrians around the year 722 B.C. But now the southern kingdom still had David's descendants on the throne. And so they surely thought that we'll be okay. And yet God sent messengers to them, Jeremiah and others, telling them, you've got to turn back. Until finally he said, there is no more turning back and relenting of my punishment that I'm bringing upon you. The punishment is coming. Captivity is coming. I am sending a people from the north and they're going to take you. And if you'll listen to what I say, you can still be delivered from the standpoint that you won't be killed. But the city of Jerusalem and the nation of Judah, it's gone. So in the year 605, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to the area of Jerusalem and he started taking away captives. Among those that he took were Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and other ruling people, other the elite, as we might call them. And they were taken away into captivity, but the city of Jerusalem hadn't fallen yet. And they were still hanging on to the thought that maybe, just maybe, they could be delivered. But they wouldn't turn back to God. And so finally, some almost 20 years later, Nebuchadnezzar comes back and he levels Jerusalem, completely destroying it. But Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego had been in captivity for these 20 years. And it goes on for another 20 years or so more after that, about 25 years more after that, with Nebuchadnezzar ruling. And these four guys had risen up in the government of the Babylonians, and they were considered high in the rankings. They were close confidants. They were advisors and counselors to King Nebuchadnezzar because they had shown the wisdom and the knowledge of the Most High God, the only God, but to them, the Most High. But Nebuchadnezzar died, and his kingdom passed on down, and yet Daniel was still around, kind of in the background. Till finally, around the year 539 B.C., a king rose up by the name of Belshazzar. Now, Belshazzar was king, but in reality, he was probably more like a co-regent, a co-king. His dad, Nabonidus, was still really the king. But he didn't really want the position of king, so he just kind of always stayed on vacation, as it were. And so he kind of left the ruling to his son. And so he was also called king. Well, Belshazzar, it tells us in Daniel chapter 5, decided to have a banquet. And it was a banquet that was primarily composed of drinking. And he brought in 1,000 of his lords, 1,000 of the high people in the land, and they were there and they were having their great banquet. And he was up in a high position, it says. In other words, he was in a position where all the other ones could see him and view him, and so that they would understand that he's the man. And after a little while, he started feeling the effects of the wine that he was drinking. And he had this great idea. He said, go and get all of the utensils. That is, all of the, let me read it for sure. He said, the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. He says, you go and get those vessels and you bring them to us so that I can, and so that my lords and my wives and my concubines can use these golden vessels that were used in the temple of Jerusalem, the temple of the Jews. We can use them in our banquet. Now, these vessels had been brought by Nebuchadnezzar, and they had been put in the house of his God, and they had been put up as sacred type vessels. And now Belshazzar says, you go and get them and let's use them in our party. So they go and get them. And they bring them back and they distribute them out and they're using them. And while they're using them, they're praising their own gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, it says. But as they were drinking, Belshazzar looks, and over beyond the candlestick that is beyond their lamps where they can, you know, they didn't have electric lights like we had. They had these lamps of candles, lights everywhere, and he could see across the way beyond that, riding in the plaster of the wall, a hand, just a hand. And it writes words in the wall. And he's sitting there and he's watching this hand writing the words in the wall, and he begins to change his color. Not on purpose, by the way. But what would you do if you saw a hand all of a sudden writing in the wall? And it says that he lost control of his bodily functions from the time. He couldn't control himself because he was so scared. His knees were knocking together because he was so scared. And he hurriedly calls out, bring in the wise men, the Chaldeans, the astrologers, the enchanters. And they gather them up real quick and they bring them in. He proclaims to them, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple, that is the clothing of royalty. And we'll put on them, he says, a chain of gold around their neck. We'll give them riches. And he'll be third ruler in the kingdom. You see, I've already mentioned to you that his dad was really the king, but he was acting as king because dad was just around. So the highest position that he could offer to them was third in the kingdom. So the wise men came in, but they couldn't do it. They could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Now, side note very quickly. You'd think by now they would understand that their wise men weren't all that wise, wouldn't you? This was not the first time that this has happened. Nebuchadnezzar had it happen twice to him where he had a vision and he called out for his wise men and they couldn't do it. So you'd think by now they would these guys didn't have any special powers. They weren't guided by God, but nonetheless, these guys, the wise men, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, the astrologers, they couldn't do it. And that made Belshazzar even more scared and perplexed and confused, as well as all the people that were with him. But because of all the ruckus that was going on, you can imagine that the royal palace, the banquet hall, was filled with all kinds of news going on, right? If you ever want to, you know, cause a ruckus, have a little rumor started out on the plant floor, and boy, it'll go around just like wildfire, right? It'll just boom, it'll be everywhere. Well, you can imagine something like this happens, and they call in the wise, it's just everywhere. So the queen hears about it. Now the queen, we don't know exactly who she is, but it appears that she was not, obviously, his wife, but someone that probably, based upon the way that she talks, someone that was probably married to Nebuchadnezzar way back when, maybe a young wife of his. But someone who is very familiar with the happenings of Nebuchadnezzar. So she comes in and she says, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is someone in your kingdom, she says, that has the spirit of the holy gods. Someone that your father, and she didn't mean that literally, but someone who is in the line before him of kings, Nebuchadnezzar, found out that had light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods. And because of this, Nebuchadnezzar had made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because he has an excellent spirit. He has knowledge and understanding to interpret dreams, to explain riddles, and to solve problems. This man, she said, his name is Daniel. But Nebuchadnezzar called him Belteshazzar. Go and get this Daniel, she says, and he will show the interpretation. So they send out the call for Daniel, and Daniel comes. Now, where Daniel was before now, exactly, we don't know, but he was around, obviously. Daniel was no longer a young man. He had been in the area, again, around 65 years just in captivity. So he wasn't a young man anymore. But he comes before the king, and the king kind of goes back through the whole thing and says, I've heard that you're this wise guy and that you've got the spirit in you and so forth and so on. And he reminds him and he tells him, now I've already asked all my wise men that if they can read the words and interpret the meaning, then I will give unto him the chain of gold. I'll put on him purple raiment and I'll make him third in the line, third most powerful in the kingdom. So Daniel, he says, if you can do this, it's the same benefit to you. So Daniel, first and foremost, says, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. He says, King, I'm not here for myself. And you don't have to bribe me because I can't be bribed. But, he says, nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. He says, I'll tell you what it says and what it means. But he begins by giving a little bit of a history lesson. He says, you remember, king, how that the God Most High made your father, again, in the line, Nebuchadnezzar, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. He gave him all of these things. The God of heaven did that. And because he gave him all of that, Nebuchadnezzar was able to basically say, this person shall live and this person shall die, because he made all people fear him. But you remember also, O king, that there came a point in time when Nebuchadnezzar was proud in his heart, when he forgot that it was God that gave him all of these things. And when he was proud in his heart and lifted up and his spirit was hardened, he was brought down from his kingly throne. And his glory was taken from him. He was driven from the children of men, and he was made to dwell with the wild donkeys, with the mind of a beast. We all remember that, right? But then, when he realized that it's the Most High God that rules in the kingdom of men, he was restored to his position. He says, now you, Belshazzar, you have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all of these things. But instead of humbling your heart, you've lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You've taken the vessels of his house, and you have brought them in before you. And you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose breath or whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. And so from his very presence, he said, he sent the hand. And this is the message. Mene, mene, tekel upharsin. I have no idea if that's close. We're going with it. That's the way the guy on the internet said it. So there you go. Mene, mene, tekel upharsin. Mene, your days, he says, has been numbered. God has numbered the days of your kingdom, and it is going to be brought to an end. Tekel, You have been weighed in the balances, and you have been found wanting. Perez, a parson, same basic word. Your kingdom is divided, and it will be given to the Medes and the Persians. When Belshazzar hears the words and he hears the interpretation, to his credit, he keeps his word. He calls for the robes to be brought. He calls for the chain to be brought. And they give them to Daniel. And he makes him third in the line. But that night, that very night, Belshazzar is slain. And Cyrus and his king, or his army, takes the area of Babylon. And they make Darius the Mede governor, as it were, over Babylon. Belshazzar. Do you realize that we often use one of the terms, one of the phrases that are used in this particular story? We use it all the time. It's an idiom, as it were. And what we say there often is that maybe we'll have somebody at work that up and all of a sudden resigns. And it happens quite frequently at our place. I don't know why that is. But they'll resign. And then the rumors start. Why did he resign? Why did he do this? Why did he do that? And then you start hearing some other stuff. Well, you know, he's got a new boss now. And oh, we heard about this. We heard about this. And say, oh, well, he must have saw the writing on the wall. That comes from this story. What we say is he could see the end coming. And so, therefore, instead of being fired, he resigned. He went out on his own terms, as it were. He could see the writing on the wall. Belshazzar could see the writing on the wall. But he needed help to understand it. And Daniel provided that help. There are two quick points we want to make from it that we can apply to our own lives. Number one, when Daniel looked at him and he said, "This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, or Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end." Do you realize that our days are numbered as well? To number them simply means to count in some respects, but it also means to fix the limit of. To fix the limit of. Our earthly life is limited. Especially brief as you compare it to eternity. Job said in Job 14 and verse 1, "Man who is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble." Few days and full of trouble. David, in 1 Chronicles chapter 29, had brought his son Solomon before the assembly, and he was blessing his son Solomon, and he was basically presenting him to the people, and he was telling them about the great job that he had before them and the preparations that he had made. And then with him in front of the assembly, he begins to pray to God and thank God for all the help that he has done so that maybe he would help his son Solomon as well. But in the midst of all of that, he remembers the frailty of man. And he says in verse 15, "For we are strangers before you and sojourners, as all our fathers were. Our days on earth are like a shadow, and there is no abiding." You know what happens to a shadow? It fades very quickly. When the sun moves, it's gone. When the sun goes down, it's for sure gone. Moses in Psalm 90, the whole chapter, talks about the everlasting, eternal nature and the great power of God. And then he compares it to man. And then he says, if we can get 70 years or even 80, then we're blessed. And so he says in verse 12 of that psalm, "Teach us to number our days. Teach us to remember that our days are but few." And so that's why over in James chapter 4, verses 13 through 17, James talks about the egotistical way that men plan for the future. How that they'll look out and say, "We'll go to such and such a place, and there we'll spend a year, and there we'll do business." And he says, and you forget God in all of it, not realizing that your life is but a vapor. It appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Our days are numbered. But what we need to realize is that it's not the number of days that's important. It's not the number of days that makes your life worthwhile or successful. It's not those who live the longest on the earth that are the winners. Rather, it's those who make the most use of their time while they're here in order to glorify God and to help others. Over in the book of 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 6, a passage that you know very well and could probably quote, "For I am already being poured out as an offering, and the time of my departure has come. I have fought a good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing." In this race that we're running, there is not just one crown. In this race that we're running, it's not given to us the person who is the fastest, thankfully. It's not given to just the person who can run the longest, thankfully. It's a race of fidelity. It's a race of faithfulness. It's a race of steadfastness. It's a race of trust in God. It's a race where the victors are simply the one who finish the race. Whether that's a few steps or a lot, you must finish. A crown of life is given to all those who have loved his appearing, that is, who look forward to his return and live in such a way to glorify him by obedience to him. That's why he tells us and encourages us in many passages to redeem the time. Ephesians chapter 5 verses 15 through 17. Colossians chapter 4 and verse 5. Redeeming the time because the days are evil. It's not just making the most of our time because the days are evil, but also making the most use of our time because we are given opportunities. And that's how we make the most of our time. Not how many days, but what we do with the ones that we have. Mene, our days are numbered. Tikwa. Daniel told Belshazzar, "You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting." Now, this was obviously not the only event in the life of Belshazzar that would have caused this to happen. Daniel obviously knew from the revealing of God that God had weighed the whole life of Belshazzar. He had weighed it, as it were, in a balance. Now, we don't use balances, but they did then. But the idea of a balance is you're expected to give 5 pounds worth of wheat or 5 pounds worth of whatever, and so they put a 5 pound, countermeasure? Okay, we'll go with that. A 5 pound countermeasure over here on this side, right? A standard. 5 pound standard over here, right? And then on this side, you keep filling up until it... That's 5 pounds. God had put, as it were, in the scales, what he expected out of Belshazzar as a ruler. Over here. And then he started weighing it. And the life of Belshazzar, the physical life of Belshazzar, his morals, his political life, his spiritual life, he put up in the balances and he said, "You're wanting. You don't measure up." Daniel told him, "And you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all of this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you. And you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored." He had mocked the God of heaven. You know what? It's never been profitable to mock God. "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" said Pharaoh. He found out, didn't he? The children of Israel and the people of Judah mocked God over and over by rejecting his prophets. Look back at Isaiah chapter 57 where he says, "You have mocked me. And you have turned to idols and you've turned to all these stones." And he says, "Now when it comes time, call to them." During the time of Christ, when God gave the best of heaven, men mocked him. The Jews mocked him, beat on him, hit on him. "Prophesy to us, which one hit you?" They put a crown of thorns on him and put a robe around him and said, and they mocked him as the king. They put him on a cross and they mocked him and said, "If you're the Son of God, come down." And yet God was victorious. Jesus defeated death. It's never profitable to mock God. And yet, how many people today, how many of us, if we're not careful, mock God? Do you realize that we mock God when we fail to receive God's word as final, as true, and unchanging? We mock God when we fail to believe that God is both loving and just. We mock God when we think that Christ's church is not important. We mock God when we fail to think that worshiping God is demanded by his children. Not suggested. Nope, I didn't say suggested. Worshiping God is demanded of his children. We mock God when we think we can live like we want to Monday through Saturday and just make up for it on Sunday. And I've done gone from preaching to meddling in my own life. You know, we mock God when we think that we can keep our hearts divided, where we can serve God and whatever else we want to at the same time. Mocking God's not profitable. It wasn't for Belshazzar, it wasn't for Pharaoh, it wasn't for the people of Israel and the people of Judah, and it won't be for us. In the end, we need to understand that all of our ways, just like his, will be weighed. It will be judged. In the book of Proverbs chapter 30 and verse 17, it says, "The eye that mocks a father and scorns to obey a mother will be picked out by the ravens of the valley and eaten by the vultures." And you say, okay. That passage is really talking about the necessity of children to heed the instruction of their parents, because their parents, hopefully this will sound a little bit familiar to you from the lesson this morning, the parents want what's good for their children. But the spiritual application is there, isn't it? The one who would mock a father and scorn to obey the instructions of the father, it's not going to come out well for them. God's instructions, his warnings, are meant to turn our ways to him so that he can bless, so that he can save. And those who refuse will experience his displeasure, his wrath, and his judgment. Over in the book of Romans, chapter 14. In Romans chapter 14, and we'll just drop down to verse 10. Paul says, "Why do you pass judgment on your brother? Or why do you despise your brother? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. For it is written, 'As I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God.' So then, each of us will give an account of himself to God." You have been weighed and measured. You have been found wanting. There are a lot of other lessons that we could look at from this particular event. We could look at how the lives of faithfulness of men can impact others. I mean, think about it. Daniel had been living faithfully for years and years and years in the land of Babylon, and a land that was foreign to his own, and a land that he didn't really want to be in. And yet, because of his life of faithfulness, even though it appears that he was in the background, now the queen remembered him, didn't she? And when a time of need came, she remembered him. Homer Haley once said, one can never really realize fully the leavening influence faithful lives can have on the world. You really never know how much impact and influence that you have on other people. We could learn from this particular event that national sins bring about national judgment. Do you realize that God used Babylon as a judicial instrument against the nation of Judah? But that didn't elevate them above being punished themselves for their own sins. Lots of lessons we could learn. But the question is, are we learning the ones that are most obvious to us? Our days are numbered, and we will be weighed and measured. Do we apply them? If we understand those things, then we need to listen to the exhortation of Peter when he says, what sort of people ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming day of God? You have an opportunity now, if you've never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, to come to him. He has provided all that you need. But if you've done that and you've fallen away, you have that opportunity as well. God still wants you to come back. God is loving. He loves us so much that he gave his son, but God is just. And there's coming a day when we'll all have to give an account of the things that we've done. So if there's anything we can do to assist you tonight, we'd ask you to come while we stand and while we sing.